Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson, here with Steve Rendell. This week on Counterspin, Ariel Sharon died on January 11th, and media send-offs included a lot about the former Israeli prime minister's historic role and his dedication to Israel's defense and security. But they often glossed lightly over the darker aspects of Sharon's record. We'll talk with Rashid Khalidi, Columbia University's Edward Said Professor of Modern Arab Studies, about what was often missing in coverage of Sharon's death. Also on the show, many public radio listeners have been dismayed to hear puff pieces about hydraulic fracking on NPR, and then to hear ads from the fracking industry. One group recently took their concerns right to the source. We'll hear from Drew Hudson of Environmental Action about what happened at that meeting with NPR. All of that's coming up, but first, as usual, we'll take a look back at the week's press.
Why did the U.S. invade Iraq? That might seem like a silly question, but in all the media coverage about the current violent state of that country, we've seen some rather curious media references to the start of the war. On ABC World News, anchor Diane Sawyer said Iraq was a place, quote, where so many brave American troops fought to create a future, close quote. Moments later, correspondent Terry Moran referred to the decade of U.S.-led war to plant democracy in Iraq. A big front-page USA Today piece had a subhead that told readers that, quote, a bloodied America wonders what could have been, close quote. The 2003 U.S. invasion gave birth to what was the Arab world's only democracy, as the paper put it. And the New York Times had a lengthy piece that explained that the current trouble in Iraq has, quote, renewed questioning about the efficacy of outside efforts to resolve the deep and bitter conflicts of the Middle East, close quote. An invasion to rid Iraq of weapons it did not have is what unleashed the bloody sectarian war happening there now. Talking about that invasion as an effort to plant democracy might comfort those who launched it, but it does a great disservice to the truth.
After weeks of sarcastic denials, New Jersey Governor Chris Christie was forced to acknowledge that several high-level staffers did, in fact, engineer a massive traffic jam near the George Washington Bridge in an apparent act of political retribution against the city of Fort Lee. Now, some in the national press, which to this point has shown a fondness for Christie, are wondering if maybe, just maybe, Christie could be branded as, yes, a bully. Stories add up as bully image trails Christie, was one New York Times headline, making it sound as though Christie is being stalked by this menacing image. Another Times story said the scandal could change his image. Quote, what once seemed like a refreshing forcefulness may come off as misguided bullying, close quote. Or as USA Today put it, quote, Christie said he knew nothing about the plot, but it could sour his national image as a tough-talking, problem-solving pragmatist into that of a partisan bully, close quote. Well, the peculiar reporting seems to prioritize image management over reality, because in reality, Christie's been a bully for some time. It's hard to think of other politicians who behave as boorishly, asking a reporter, are you stupid? Calling political opponents and citizens groups hacks and SOBs. And this is hardly the first sign of retribution. Rutgers professor Alan Rosenthal saw his state funding slashed after backing a redistricting map more favorable to Democrats last year. Then there's Christie's record of attacks on public sector workers and school teachers, like the one he screams at in a viral video. So, yeah, the current scandal could see the media brand Christie as a bully. The question would be why it took them so long.
That's one take on Christie. Fox News has another. On its Media Watch show hosted by Howard Kurtz, his roundtable was discussing whether or not Christie is a bully when Kurtz asked veteran Fox pundit Britt Hume about the bully narrative.
Well, I would have to say that in this sort of feminized atmosphere in which we exist today, guys who were masculine and muscular like that in their private conduct and kind of old-fashioned tough guys run some risks.
Feminized
atmosphere.
By which you mean?
By which I mean that men today have learned the lesson the hard way that if you act like a kind of an old-fashioned guy's guy, you're in constant danger of slipping out and saying something that's going to get you in trouble and make you look like a sexist or make you look like you seem thuggish or whatever. That's the atmosphere in which you operate. This guy's very much an old-fashioned, masculine, muscular guy, and there are political risks associated with that.
So when you go around screaming at teachers, that's just your old-fashioned, masculine, muscular guy slipping out. Makes you wonder what slips out at Fox News when the cameras aren't rolling.
The Washington Post's January 11th editorial on so-called free trade agreements was classic, encouraging the renewal of those fast-track procedures that allow Congress to push through the controversial pacts without amendments or much deliberation. In calling for less debate on a highly debatable set of issues, the Post matter-of-factly declared that such trade agreements, quote, could help the U.S. economy grow and create employment, close quote. And they offered their own revealing explanation for why there's opposition in the first place. Skepticism on such measures, the paper said, has, quote, arguably grown in the 12 years since the last fast-track bill passed, due to the recession and the rise of the Tea Party with its anxiety about ceding U.S. sovereignty, close quote. Well, if the Post listened more to actual opponents of these agreements, they'd be unlikely to hear anything about the Tea Party and a lot about the devastating impact, the relocation of corporations to low-income countries like China that these agreements facilitate, has had on U.S. workers' jobs and incomes. The L.A. Times' Howard Meyerson noted that in all the recent articles and editorials he's seen celebrating the 20th anniversary of NAFTA, quote, not one of them has so much as mentioned the agreement's effect on U.S. employment, wages, or trade balance, close quote. It's certainly much easier to say there's no need for debate if you ignore opponents' arguments. Or, as with the Post, you just make them up yourself.
And finally, the editor's note in the January 27th issue of Time magazine begins, quote, I don't know anyone who's in a hurry to start the 2016 presidential campaign, close quote. Indeed, speculation about a race 2 years away is of little value and can't help but crowd out other current stories, as well as narrow the public's expectations of what issues the campaign might engage and who it might include. So a good thing for media to acknowledge. What's the problem? The cover story of the issue is about Hillary Clinton's 2016 campaign.
Thanks, Steve. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR.
Ariel Sharon's death elicited a torrent of coverage touting the former Israeli prime minister's leadership and place in Israeli history. There was plenty about his fierce dedication to Israeli defense and security, but the coverage left one with the sense that reporters knew of the darker aspects of Sharon's record, but mostly kept the information to themselves. With us to discuss Sharon's record and legacy is Rashid Khalidi. He is the Edward Said Professor of Modern Arab Studies at Columbia University. Khalidi was in Lebanon in 1982 during Israelis' invasion of that country, a bloody episode orchestrated by then-Israeli Defense Minister Ariel Sharon. Khalidi has a piece on foreignpolicy.com about Sharon and the coverage of his death. Welcome back to Counterspin, Rashid Khalidi.
Thanks for having me again.
Well, let's begin in Lebanon, since that's what many say was Sharon's most disgraceful and bloody episode. There was a piece on the BBC website on January 11th titled, No Tears Will Be Shed for Ariel Sharon in Lebanon. Judging from your foreignpolicy.com piece, I would guess that you would call that an understatement.
It certainly is an understatement. Anyone who is old enough to remember, and I think a lot of people who were very young at the time, thinks of that summer of 1982 in terms of the trauma that it inflicted on everybody present in Lebanon, and especially people who were present in West Beirut, which was under siege for the better part of 8 weeks, bombarded for 10 weeks. According to a Lebanese police report issued that year in late 1982, over 19,000 people were killed during that war and more than 30,000 wounded. So this was a huge, terrible event which has been completely elided, unfortunately, in most of the coverage. It's mentioned, but that this was a war of choice, this was a war of aggression, this was a war based on deception, this was a war that had nothing to do with Israel's security, but had to do with expansionist, aggressive aims that Sharon, every analyst, every proper Israeli analyst of that war has laid out in great detail, was completely obscured in the coverage. This was not a controversial episode. These were major war crimes. The very war itself was a war crime. And enormous, horrible massacres were carried out, not only in Sabra and Shatila. There were several others in the course of that war.
Well, working back, one could say that Sharon's career was sort of born in bloodshed.
That is true. I mean, he began as a fighter in the 48 war when he was wounded, but he first came to prominence in the early 50s when he was selected by the Israeli military leadership at the time to head a unit which was designed to give the tone to Israel's relations with its Arab neighbors. And that tone was set in a massacre that took place in a little village called Qibya in 1953, when that unit, in response to the murder of three Israelis, a woman and her kids, by infiltrators, attacked a village which, as far as we know, had nothing to do with this. And in any case, did so in a way that United Nations observers, a man named Benningsen, who was the UN, I believe he was a Norwegian truce officer, described in graphic detail in the report at the time. The soldiers fired at the doors of the houses so people could not get out, and the houses were then blown up over their inhabitants. 69 people died, and many dozens were wounded. This was an atrocity. And this was the beginning of Sharon's career. It was the beginning of his advancement to the very top of Israeli politics, and it was meant, and it set the tone, and was meant to set the tone. Israel would reply or respond or retaliate massively, brutally against civilians any time an Israeli was harmed, and 69-3 is about the ratio of civilians murdered in response to the killing of Israelis in the decades that followed. So it set the tone in that sense, and it set the tone in terms of deception and dissembling. The Israeli prime minister pretended publicly that this was the action of rogue elements who were simply responding out of anger to the murder of these innocent Israeli civilians, whereas, in fact, it had been an action ordered by the Israeli high command deliberately and covered up by the Israeli government deliberately because it reflected policy. So Israel's shooting at people and then claiming that, in fact, A, it was retaliation, which in a sense it was, but B, that in fact they were not responsible, is characteristic of the way in which Israel has, I think, dealt with its environment in the decades since. And so he was there at the beginning, in a sense, Sharon, in every sense of the word.
Well, it goes without saying that reporting on the death of such an historical figure ought to include all this stuff. But there's something else. It's just not a matter of omission. It's also a matter, the reporting of distortion by commission. That is the portrayal of Sharon as a peacemaker, based mostly on his having disengaged, a funny word in this context, from Gaza.
Yes. Well, this is part of the Orwellian language that is a staple of American policymaking and of the Israeli approach. When Israel besieges controls from without and essentially starves the population of Gaza, which has been the policy that was adopted after the so-called disengagement, this is called a step towards peace. When the United States brokers a process whereby Palestinian land continues to be colonized and stolen and Palestinians continue to be continuously restricted in their movement, this is described as a peace process. That's what's been going on since the Madrid Peace Conference. The Palestinians have lost much more of their land than they had back in 1991. And Israeli settlement has expanded from 200,000 illegal settlers to nearly 600,000 illegal settlers in the occupied West Bank and occupied Arab East Jerusalem. So that is par for the course, talking about what Sharon did in 2004 as a step towards peace is really truly grotesque. What he intended to do was to more firmly establish Israel's hold over those territories he thought that it could control directly, the West Bank and East Jerusalem, while maintaining indirect control over Gaza, which Israel has to this day. Israel is still, technically, if you go and look at the CIA website, if you go and look at how American policy describes Gaza, it's still technically under occupation because entry into and exit from and control of the Gaza Strip is still maintained by Israel. Israel doesn't police the Strip directly from within the Strip, and it did remove its colonists, its illegal settlers, but only in the American media and in Israel are such steps seen, and by people who are party to this, like Tony Blair, is this seen in any way in a positive light. Of course, that's the way our media spin it.
Well, you spoke of Sharon's legacy of brutality and mendacity and other things being carried forward to the present.
Mm-hmm.
How do you think the press did in covering that legacy? Did they look at it at all?
The mainstream media deserves an F for its coverage. It was really the most pathetic instance of following a lead set by both American policymakers and the Israeli government that I've ever seen. This is a man who at the very least should have been pictured in black and white. He was essentially whitewashed. He was essentially turned into a saint. Or at least all of the saintly aspects were emphasized, and the quite negative aspects were minimized if they were mentioned at all. It was quite disgraceful. I think the New York Times, frankly, reached a low, and that is something that's very hard for the Times to do, given the abysmal quality of much of its coverage of this issue.
We have been speaking with Rashid Khalidi, the Edward Said Professor of Modern Arab Studies at Columbia University. He is the author most recently of Brokers of Deceit, How the U.S. Has Undermined Peace in the Middle East. You can read his piece on Sharon at foreignpolicy.com. Thanks again for joining us today on Counterspin, Rashid Khalidi.
Thanks for having me.
It's distressing enough for people concerned about the environment to hear stories on National Public Radio that present hydraulic fracking as not just a source of safe energy, but also an economic boon. When that's combined with the network's airing ads from the fracking industry, the questions only multiply. One activist group expressed those concerns in a petition to NPR that collected some 45,000 signatures, but they didn't stop there. In December, they went to NPR, expecting to meet with the ombud, Edward Schumacher Matos, and they wound up with an opportunity to do more than that. Joining us now to explain what they made of that opportunity is Drew Hudson. He's executive director with the group Environmental Action. He joins us now by phone from South Carolina. Welcome to Counterspin, Drew Hudson.
Thanks for having me.
Well, first, let us know what was in that petition you were taking to NPR. What did those 45,000 people want to say?
Yes, so as you said in your introduction, this started with a lot of listeners to NPR, as many of us are, hearing the pro-fracking spots from the Natural Gas Alliance that encouraged us to think about all the wonderful benefits. While we knew the facts were very different about contaminated drinking water, polluted streams, and a lot of communities all across America really suffering under the impacts of fracking. About 45,000 folks had signed on to a petition asking NPR to reconsider two things. The first was to reject the financing from the Natural Gas Alliance, which we believe is poisoning their news coverage just like it's poisoning so many water supplies across America. And the second one was to reevaluate the way that they're covering the whole issue of fracking and energy in America. Too much of the stories we hear seem to present fracking as clean or natural, when in fact it's anything but, and as too many communities around the country have already seen, you know, the gas industry comes in promising a lot of good jobs and benefits, as well as a cleaner and more sustainable energy future for all of America, and the facts are really very different. And we count on NPR to bring us fact-based reporting to really dig into these issues, and instead we were hearing a lot of puff pieces that were reporting misinformation from the gas industry itself, and so that's what we wanted them to change.
Well, and again, before we even get to the meeting, you're saying concerns were on more than one level. There was the rose-colored presentation of fracking, and then there was NPR's taking this sponsorship money from the industry, and there was also a double standard in terms of ads. I mean, they are willing to run those ads from the industry, but not willing to run certain other kinds of ads. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, absolutely. One of the things that happened as members were signing the petition, we were looking for a way to present our concerns about fracking on the air. And it was actually a suggestion from one of the members who said, you know, look, if the Gas Alliance can buy airtime, why can't we do the same thing, get our message out, tell people about the dangers of fracking and encourage them to get some real information that's not presented by people who are making a profit from this really dangerous drilling technique. So we raised money from all the folks who had signed the petition, actually ended up raising about $10,000 online from small donors all around the country. and went to the biggest NPR station in the country, WNYC, and said, hey, we want to put our message on the air. We want to sponsor a message that says fracking is not safe, it's not clean, and especially in a state like New York, which is considering gas drilling and at the moment has a moratorium on it, it seems really important that people be encouraged to get that information. What we found out is that there really is, as you say, a double standard at work here. The Natural Gas Alliance, with its deep pockets and tons of money from fracking all these wells around the country, is able to go in and say more or less whatever they want on the national NPR programs like Morning Edition and All Things Considered. But when you approach the local stations like WNYC or all kinds of other local affiliates around the country, they don't have that same freedom and flexibility. And in fact, they were not willing to run an ad on the air that would say words like fracking or come get the facts about dirty energy and gas. Those were phrases that they said would be too much advocacy to put on public radio, which, of course, is different than commercial radio. And so they wouldn't air our spot. We did eventually negotiate with WNYC's lawyers to get a spot out there, but it was very different from where we started. And you can find on our website, environmentalaction.org, a whole write-up of this experience and see the two ads, the one we originally produced that we wanted to air, and then what WNYC was eventually willing to approve in there. They're very different ads, though both of them do encourage people to get the facts about natural gas drilling.
Can I just underscore if the word fracking itself was considered too controversial?
Not even just fracking, but we actually had a point where I felt like I'd crossed into the twilight zone. The lawyers asked me to explain what I meant by supporting a clean energy future. That phrase was thought to be too much express advocacy for a radio ad on NPR. But yeah, the word fracking, they said, was too pejorative. It sounds like a bad thing, and therefore to even say it on the air would encourage people to be opposed to the process of drilling by fracturing. I think it goes to our real point, which is if you describe accurately the facts of fracking, that we're going to inject a slurry of toxic and yet secret chemicals into the ground with enough force to shatter the bedrock and release natural gas, nobody would think this sounds like a good idea, and that's part of the problem. It only sounds good when NPR dresses it up and says, oh, it's about clean air and jobs, and it has all these benefits, and learn how Ohio farmers are getting by thanks to fracking. These are all very misleading statements, and they don't express the real truth of this drilling technology.
Not to mention that the industry ads and ads of all sorts are underwriting acknowledgments, I guess they call them, use that sort of vague language or, you know, encouraging language all the time, it seems to me. So, well, all right, you expect to speak with the ombud. That's what usually happens if you can get that far, that is. But what happened when you actually got to NPR?
They were really delighted, I would say, to be met at the door. It wasn't until we got off the elevator on the upper floor to meet with the ombudsman that it turned out Paul Haga, who's the acting CEO of NPR right now, was waiting to meet us as well. He was an unexpected guest, and we thought at first he would, you know, say hello and appreciate our concerns and move on the way, but he actually stayed for the better part of an hour. I mean, it was a really good conversation to be a part of. Again, we were not meeting with the news department, so we were not telling them what stories to cover, but to have the CEO, really the head of the organization there, listening to concerns. And I think he was as surprised as anyone to hear some of the points we were making about gaps in NPR's coverage and how when you hear them air a story which seems so complementary to the fracking industry, or really is complementary. We had some specific examples where they had used numbers that were horribly flawed about the job benefits of gas in Pennsylvania, for example, and that, you know, that was a known fact. We could go prove that those were the wrong numbers and that they were incorrectly calculated. NPR runs a story like that and then turns right around and reads, as you say, one of these very pro-natural gas-sponsored messages. It's just hard for people not to believe that those things aren't associated, that NPR isn't choosing to cover the issue based on where their funding is coming from.
You also talk to them about how it's not just the stories they do, but the stories they don't do. And you had evidence of reports that, in fact, local affiliates had covered but somehow didn't make it up the chain. Can you tell us briefly about that?
The key story here that we think NPR had missed, or the example we were using with us at the meeting, one of the folks who came was an activist with us and other organizations named Karen, who lives in Pennsylvania and works on a lot of the anti-fracking issues there with us. And she had some very specific examples. There's a story that's come out over the course of last year that EPA actually had done its own independent research and confirmed that fracking was contaminating local drinking water in at least four places in Pennsylvania and Wyoming and in Texas, and that they knew this was happening. But at the moment where the EPA researchers discovered that to be true, under pressure from, it looks like, the White House and other political officials, EPA was basically told to shut that research down and ignore it. And that's what happened until a group of whistleblowers in the Philadelphia office of EPA leaked that information to reporters and got the story out that we knew fracking was contaminating drinking water, as we had long suspected it was. The local affiliate in Pennsylvania picked up that story and ran a couple of stories about the EPA cover-up and also about citizens in Pennsylvania whose drinking water had been contaminated, standing in solidarity with the EPA people, bringing their contaminated drinking water that, you know, the EPA had done tests on to kind of make this point to the Philadelphia regional office. That story was really good, and it aired on the local stations in Pennsylvania and, in fact, was highlighted. They have a section called State Impacts where NPR is supposedly looking for good stories from the states that they can promote up to a national audience. But that whole story about the EPA cover-up and about the Pennsylvania communities working with EPA whistleblowers was completely overlooked by the national NPR affiliate shows like Morning Edition and All Things Considered, which of course are heard by many millions more people than just the individual shows in Pennsylvania.
Well, finally, what do you and don't you expect to see from NPR going forward? And what are your plans going forward?
We're definitely not considering this a victory just because we've been heard, as it were, by the CEO and senior people at NPR. They did commit to look into this issue about missed stories and the things they're not covering, in particular about fracking and its impacts. And they promised to revisit the issue of the sponsored messages, but they certainly didn't promise to turn away all that money from the Natural Gas Alliance or anything like that. One thing we're really hopeful to see in the next few weeks is a write-up from the ombudsman, Edward Schumacher-Montos, talking about his review of the coverage and whether or not he thinks the news department has missed anything. Then we're going to do more work with local stations. We think that at the end of the day, the local affiliates, the WNYCs and WHYYs and all those people around the country are a little more receptive to listener feedback. And so we'll be doing more work in Pennsylvania, New York, and in California, because those are three places, obviously, where this drilling technology is either about to or could very soon make a big impact on their energy future and their environmental future, if it isn't already.
We've been speaking with Drew Hudson of Environmental Action. You can follow their work on the web at environmentalaction.org. Drew Hudson, thank you very much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thanks for having us.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find them on FAIR's website. It's FAIR.org. That's also the place to get subscription information for FAIR's monthly magazine called Extra, or to sign up for FAIR's Action Alert Network. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. With me is Steve Rendell. I'm Janine Jackson. Thank you for listening to Counterspin.